do so quietly.
If you're going to smoke, we ask that you please be away from any buildings. Also, we ask that you refrain from smoking e-cigarettes inside the building. If you find it necessary to smoke, please take it outside. Please be respectful as we're guests of the church. And to introduce our first speaker, we have Esperanza.
Hello, my name is Esperanza and I am an alcoholic. I remember the very first time that I got drunk. I was about 13. My father thought that it was a great idea that he get me baptized into knowing what my limits were. So he asked me what I wanted to drink, and I was like, I don't know, I've never drank. And he's like, well, I think a rum and coke would start out good. So, you know, I got totally smashed, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. And from then on, I would drink as much as I could when I could. And because I was constantly craving that, I was seeking out any way, shape, or form through using people, places, or avenues that I could get another drink or substitute. And I found myself making very, very bad decisions. I, of course, met this wonderful person, decided to get married, have a child, and you know, I thought that that would make me fulfilled. And it was never enough. You know, I couldn't love him enough. I couldn't love my daughter enough. I always felt like something was missing. So I decided to drink a lot, and my family had an intervention. DCF was called. My daughter was taken from me, and I didn't think that I had a problem. So after almost losing my first child to her being adopted out, I thought that it was a great idea to have another child, you know, because my thought process is always, well, if you don't have one thing, you know, you just replace it with another. So that's what I did. And after my second child, I decided that it was a really good idea to drink and do a lot of craziness. And both of my children were taken from me. So I decided I was going to get the heck out of Dodge and move down to Florida, woohoo, where nobody knows me. Start fresh, you know. And I moved down in October. By April of the next year, my children were taken away by DCF. That started the roller coaster of me working to get custody of my children back. And, you know, I would do, like I always did, do just enough to skate by. You know, I would show them that I was capable and willing to do just enough so that I could get what I wanted. And once I had my children back, I would start making those bad decisions again. I was incapable of staying away from a drink. And when my children were, when my parental rights were signed over, I thought that I was going to have a great idea and have another child, yay! And my children were not adopted out and they were given back to me. I was about 4 months pregnant, and I started going to a program that was working in regards to me being able to get custody of them. And the counselor told me, she said, you know what, you're about ready to graduate from the program. The only problem is you've not gone to any 12-step meetings. I said, oh, can't you just graduate me anyway? And she said, no, here's a list. So that very night, I went to a Tuesday meeting in St. Leo. That's where I met my first sponsor that I decided to actually use. And she started working me through the steps. And wonderful things started to happen. I started getting a job. I had never maintained a job for any longer than a year, actually 6 months. And I got a job and I started paying my bills. I didn't expect other people to pay my way. And about, I would say, 9 months later, I was able to get my youngest daughter back. And about 5 months after that, the state came to me and asked me if I would like to be a mother to my other two children that I had signed over my parental rights to. And those are the miracles that A has brought to me. And it has definitely been a very, very interesting journey. Things have not been easy, but through the help of a sponsor, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to stay sober for 8 years now. And I know for a fact that if it wasn't for those principles of this program, I would not have, you know, a single day. I was never able to put together more than 9 months clean and sober. And, you know, I have my two youngest children still living with me, and I have the hope of having a beautiful life, just as is depicted in the Big Book. Thank you so very much.
Now we'll have Tori come up and do the traditions.
Tori and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. I think they forgot to announce the fellowship is at Pit Boss tonight. Yeah. Alrighty, and Jordan's gonna come up and read, give out the chips.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jordan and I'm an alcoholic. Here at Fourth Dimension, we have a chip system to celebrate different lengths of sobriety. The first chip that we give out is a silver chip for anyone who's new and wants to give this way of life a try. Anybody new or coming back? We have a red chip for 1 month. No takers. We have a gold chip for 2 months. Strikeout tonight. Green chip for 3 months. A blue chip for 6 months. Man, this has never happened to me before. Purple chip for 9 months. There's one, buddy. That was Jessica with 9 months. Is there anyone celebrating a year? Is there anyone celebrating multiples of years? And that was Matt with 15 years. If anyone needs a big book, see one of the home group members after the meeting. And if you haven't had a drink today, give yourself and your higher power a hand.
And I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Jack.
I saw Donald Trump do this. Anyway, hi, my name is Jack and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Remember When group from Sarasota, Florida, meets on Sunday nights. My sobriety date is October 29th, 1972. And I kind of hate to say that because I should probably know a lot more than I do. But anyway, and I'm an alcoholic named Jack. Anyway, I hadn't planned on becoming an alcoholic. I don't think any of us have. I think my story lends to the fact that it's not how much you drink, but what happens to you when you do drink. And I say that because I didn't pick up a drink until my mid-20s. And frankly, I don't remember. A lot of people start off with their first drunk. I don't remember my first drunk, but I remember the drink that turned it to me. At the time I was working in Rhode Island, I had graduated from a business college, and I had gotten a job in the Superior Court, and my background was in accounting, but I wound up with a job there, and there was a rock concert that came to Rhode Island, probably about 1962, 63. People you don't even remember, it was Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis. And what a show that was. And I went with, I went all with the guys. I went with the state's attorneys, the public defenders, and the people that worked in the courthouse. And I had a drink called the Between the Sheets. Now, I didn't like drinking. My father was an alcoholic, and I knew what happened in my phone. And I swore I would never grow up like him. As a matter of fact, when I was five, he came in drunk one night, and my sister and I slid on linoleum under the bed because I never heard anything like that in my life. And I never trusted that man from that point on for what happened in the family that I grew up with. But I swore I would never drink. In school, at that time, I became the first Eagle Scout. They put your picture in the paper. And I was going to St. Raymond's, went to a Dominican Catholic school. I had the Sisters of Perpetual Pain for 9 years. And the night I got Eagle, my mother came up and she said, "Promise me you'll never turn out like your dad, your father." And I said, "I give you my word, Mom, I'll never drink." Fast forward, I'm at this rock concert this night, and I had a drink called the Between the Sheets. And let me tell you something. Don't ever drink one, but first. But that just lit something inside of me. And I had drank beer before and different things with the guys, but I never was really a drink. I never liked to go to bars or anything like that. But I liked this drink. And so I had a second one, and yours truly marched right down, got up on the stage with Fats Domino. And I became a white drummer in an all-black band. And the book uses the word extemporaneously, and I had no idea what that meant at the time, but I know what it felt like. It felt like I For the first time in a long time, I felt just as good as you are, or the way I thought you were. And then I felt a little bit better than I thought you were. But everybody I was with said, Jack, you're a different guy when you drink. You know? They didn't add, you should do this more, but that was my interpretation. Well, I had a great time that night. And these are the days you had martini lunches in the court. You take a break in the court and you go have a martini lunch. And everybody was sitting down having a martini. I ordered the between the sheets. Why did I do that? I wanted the effect. I didn't care about the drink. It had kind of a sour taste. But I wanted that effect again. It was a long trial in the afternoon. I was clerking at the time. And oh, it was going to be tough. So I learned something that day because everybody stared at you when you ordered that drink. So then it happened. It started happening fast. My wife at the time, wife number two, was 26. And we were having I wasn't equipped to go steady and I was marrying people. But we were sitting in a restaurant and there was four of us, there's two couples. And this is when I realized the worm turned inside of me. They were sitting talking and I wanted to drink. I had one drink, they all had one drink, and their drink was like just a little bit gone, mine was empty. And they were talking and I didn't want to talk. And I, for the first time, I could identify with something in the book. It talked about this restless, irritable discontent. I started feeling that. My foot started going. And let's get on with the conversation. And my wife, second wife, Mary, hit me in the knee. So, what's the matter with you? Nothing's the matter with me. I got to go to the bathroom. Went to the bartender. Before I went to the bathroom, I had my first Boilermaker. Came back from the bathroom, had my second Boilermaker, and sat down. I said, I'm going to be fine now. I hated it. I didn't want to sit there. I couldn't wait to get out. And I really had a terrible night that night as far as my wife and I were concerned, because she didn't know what was wrong with me and I didn't know I was sliding into alcoholism. I knew I was irritable because I wanted to drink and they wanted to socialize. And I found out at that moment, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about we can no longer drink like the people that have an impunity when they drink. It doesn't bother them. But it bothers me. I knew I wasn't like them anymore. So I went out and I bought a bottle of Christian Brothers Blackberry Brandy. I'm a Christian. And and I put it under the seat of my vehicle. So I would always have access. And I'm into probably 3 months from that between the sheets. I'm into 3 months. And into the fourth month, I was admitted to a mental health facility in Providence. What was wrong with me? I was acting out one weekend. And they had me in there, and I was drinking at night. We had basements in Rhode Island, and I had a dog. I had a shepherd. And shepherds are great dogs to have because you can talk to them when you're drinking. And I would talk to the dog, and I'd get a little dish of blackberry brandy in there. He would never touch it, but he'd listen to me. And God forbid Mary ever knew what was going on down there back in the boiler. God knows. And so I get admitted to this hospital and they asked me how I drank. They said, are you a social drinker? I said, no, I drink with the dog. And but they're making something a lot out of this thing, and it's not a lot to me, but it's a lot to them. And I think I was going to jump out the window or something. Nothing, no big deal. So but when I drank, I changed. And now I've got this great job at the state. Great job. And I'm sitting in this nut house making a billfold. And I don't know how quick that happened. And psychiatrists are looking at me, and they're looking at me, and I'm trying to show them how good I do at leathercraft all of a sudden. And I'm not a nut. I'm not a nut. I really am not a nut. And they kind of smiled. They said, and at the time they said, this was 1963, they said, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're an alcoholic. I said, no, no. My father, uncles. I'm first born in this country from Ireland. I guess that Irish virus. But I said, no, no. I haven't drank long enough to become an alcoholic. My plane's just taken off. I'm not crash landing right. I went back and I was told by Judge Powers of Superior Court Justice. He said, Jack, you go over to an AA meeting tonight. I'll have a friend of mine pick you up and take you to an AA meeting. I said, I don't have to go to an AA meeting. You don't have to go to an AA meeting. So happened that one afternoon I fell over the rail in court at 2 o'clock and it didn't look good, so he called me in his chambers and he gave me So this guy picked me up and took me to an AA meeting, and that time it was 8 o'clock to 9:30. Oh no, 8:30 to 10. Oh. Same speaker, hour and a half. Like, the name was Redhead from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. I'm in Providence. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm wondering, how long does this last? I was there 15 minutes. It was enough. It was enough for me. But he brought me there and I was trying to be good. But I'll tell you, when I finished that, I'm not going back. I'll never go back to AA. And so Judge Powers gave me a choice one day. He said, you either go to AA or you resign. And I said, I don't have to resign. I've been appointed by a job by the lieutenant governor. And he said, oh, he says, you'll resign. Because you go to AA or else. And I chose to drink. I gave that job up. I gave that career up. I didn't know that my love for alcohol would impede my career goals or what I had in life. But it began to interfere. I didn't know my love for alcohol was greater than my love for my family. I didn't know that. I didn't have love for them. I didn't have love for the job. I didn't care about the career. I didn't care about anything. But that's what I wanted to do. And that's what alcohol started to do to me. And it was cascading, and I couldn't stop it, and I didn't want to stop it. I've been responsible all my life. I was always a good kid. I was halfway. You know, you get AA, when you join AA, you become a great athlete. All of a sudden, that never happened to me. But I played a lot of hockey in Providence, and let's get into my story a little bit later. But in a way, in my own thinking, I was reckless. I didn't care. I wanted to get away. I said, I'll go to Denver, Colorado. I'll shock my wife. After I got out of the hospital, it was a big scene in the family. My family came over. They treated me very well when I was in the hospital because they'd never seen anything like this in their life before, as far as I was concerned. But when this was happening, they were kind of rewarding me for go to this nut house. You shouldn't do that with an alcoholic, I don't think. But that's what they didn't know any better. But when they let me out, I wanted to get away. I wanted to get out. I knew what was going to happen to me. I knew I wasn't going to be a good parent. I wasn't going to be a good husband. I certainly wasn't going to be a good employer. So employee. So I said, I'll go to Denver, Colorado. I was sitting looking at a Hams beer commercial, and I said, looks like Colorado, a place I'd like to go. I didn't discuss it with anybody, but I got on a plane and went, and I called Mary, and I said, Mary, I'm going to Colorado. She said, good, go. And I went. And I had no idea what I was going to do out there. I could get a job on a ranch, work with that. And I got out there and I got a job at Gates Rubber Company in Denver, Colorado. I was fired promptly after 2 weeks for drinking on the job. And I was arrested for the first time. I was kind of protected in Providence, never arrested, but the protection's gone now. And I really caught a good one on the bar one night when I got my ribs kicked in. They took me to Denver General Hospital. I don't do that well. I don't do that well fighting when I drink. I found that out. And although my head thinks so, not there. And I went to Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, with the Day-to-Day Saints. And I went to a halfway house. They had a halfway house there for alcoholics. I'm in my 6th or 7th month drinking. I'm in a halfway house. And I had an affair in the halfway house with a woman. And you got to be clear on that. She was 82. Funny. This is severe alcoholism. And I was 26. But she had a packet. And she had other substances. It was unbelievable. And so we moved out. We moved out. We moved in together. And she was really something. Except one morning I woke up, and she was laying there. And the 82-year-old looked different. The hair was gone. The teeth were gone. The mouth was open, and I didn't think she was breathing. And we drank tequila that night, and that scared me to death. I said, oh my God, I don't believe I did that. I don't believe I did this. And so Eva was her name, she's a good gal, but there was something wrong with that. And she put me on a bus and sent me to LA, and I arrived in Los Angeles. If anybody knows Clancy, I was a block away from where his mission is, 7th and San Pedro. And I started working out of day labor. And now, if you said to me, Jack, How did your life go after you had that between your sheets? Well, it went pretty good. I went to a nut house, lost my job, fell in love with an 82-year-old and threw me out. I'm now working unloading boxcars. Pretty good. Life is pretty good. I'm on a table one day in a blood bank and I'm selling a pint of blood for wine. And I'm not going in a good direction. And I can't believe how fast this is happening. And I can't believe how fast the time started going by. And it was 2 years, it was 3 years. I could not get off that street. I always stayed in a hotel, always worked, did something. And I went to AA, started going to AA. Because I knew from that first meeting, although I didn't like the meeting, I knew there was something there. You see, I was talking to Phil a little bit earlier. In this room, there's a spirit in this room. We can't put our finger on it. But you can go to a meeting and have a really bad day. And 15 minutes later after a meeting, you start settling in. And it's going to be okay that day. Do you ever notice that happening to you? And that's what happened to me at that meeting that night. I had that feeling. It's a spirit. I couldn't put my finger on it, but something hooked me there. And so I went down and I joined this group on Sunset Strip. Nice group. Did nice cars. I had Bentleys, Mercedes, Jaguars. I had a Huffy. And the group embraced me. They took me in. And they started telling me things I had to hear. And I got to believe them, and I stayed sober. And I got a job at All Right Auto Park, and I was parking cars out of identity. I had my name on my shirt, doing pretty good, not drinking. And I started doing a group inventory, and one person at a time. And one Friday night, I painted myself right out of that group and out of that door. That Saturday morning, I went to work, and a lady asked me to move her car. I said, I'd be happy to. I moved it to San Francisco. But that morning, I got myself a little bottle of Tokay, which is kind of a wine, real cheap wine, and Orange Rock, something else, and I took off to San Francisco. And don't ask me why I did that, because I knew a little bit about the law. I knew that she gave me the key of the car. She can't call police in 24 hours. I knew that. I didn't know the liability, and I didn't know the legality of breaking that down to joyriding. I just automatically would happen from Grand Theft Auto. This is all through my mind as I'm driving up the coast of California, San Francisco. I get up there, they towed the car, I went to get the car. They arrested me, they put me in handcuffs, and brought me back in what they call a chain, and sent me to LA County Jail. And so I went before the judge for the first time, a little bit serious. And I asked the judge, I told him what I did with my experience working in the court system, and I appreciate if he broke it down the joyride. And when I never say that to a judge, never. Because he said, he gave me 6 months in jail. 6 months in jail, in LA County Jail. Do you know what that's like? No. It isn't pretty, man. It isn't pretty. Charlie Manson was downstairs. It was absolutely insane. Sirhan had shot Kennedy that year. They brought him in. I finally worked myself, though, you can do this in jail, to the corner bunk where the light came in and you could read at night. And I'm reading Tolstoy. And I got to go to court and my 6 months is up. And I can't go to court straight. I have to have something. There's nothing you can get in there. But at the time, you could have shaving lotion, banana peels. Do you ever smoke banana peels? What I told you about between the sheets, don't ever smoke banana peels. But some had said it was a good idea, so I rolled a bone and I had some shaving lotion just to take the edge off. Now, they got me up at 4:30, and I was ready to go. I was feeling a little bit giddy, but my tongue started swelling up. And I got a headache, and I went in front of the judge. And you know, you say, and I'm going to explain to the judge, well, I had to get a little bit high. I just to take the edge off. That's all I wanted to do, and I couldn't say that to the judge. I didn't have the honesty or the wherewithal to even say that to him because I couldn't speak. He said, this guy's in work shape, the one he come in, cut him loose. I went up to San Francisco. Timothy Leary showed up with LSD. I didn't bother with that. Started trying to legalize pot, got arrested at 17. I wasn't even smoking pot. I was just chasing the gals around who were doing it, so I carried the sign, they got nailed. But I went up to Oregon, but my life was in the sewer. It was in the sewer. I was trying to go to AA. I was trying to get sober. I was trying to stay sober. Halfway houses. I've been in a ton of them. And I'd go out. Eventually, I'd go out. And I just couldn't stop this from happening. I went to Portland, Oregon. I got a job there as a valet parker for a wedding. Bad idea for me. And I had this little red vest on. And I was drinking with the bride's father. And a guy came in and he threw his keys at me. He says, "Move my car, kid. You should never talk to me like that. And I've had three drinks. Never." So I grabbed the keys. I said, "I'll move your car." Thank you. Took it right to Seattle. And if you want to see the best driver around, steal a Jaguar. You drive straight. You sober up like a judge. Nobody, you can give probable cause. Nobody's going to have that with this guy driving. But where do I pull into now at my stages of drunkenness? I pull into the Salvation Army with a Jaguar, put the key on the tire, and check in like I'm going to the Ritz. They made me a bell ringer. I've been at this thing now almost 10 years, and I can't stop it. It sounds like it's fun. It's not fun. I am getting more into madness. I was getting audio hallucinations where I'd open a fridge and I'd hear music playing and I'd shut the fridge. I had a furry thing starting to follow me around. Man, and you're running away from this thing and you can't tell anybody that there's a furry thing while there's music in the fridge. And I would hear this madness at AA meetings and I couldn't tell anybody. I could never talk about what I was going through. And so I got fired from my Salvation Army job, the bell ringer's job, because I got into the pot, got some money, got some wine, out you go. Next day I went shopping, I applied for a job, and I laughed when I did this. And this shows you the arrogance and the ignorance of a personality. I applied for the job the next day as an auditor for a hotel chain and got the job. And I laughed at AA. I said, "You said things would get worse, and look at me now. Look at me now." I went shopping at the Salvation Army store to get a pair of shoes that match, a tie, a shirt, and I look good when I walk in. I've been interviewed, not a felony yet, so I get hired. And it took me probably, maybe 3.5 months to get back into it again. And to get back into something different, which was illegal, which is called embezzlement and conspiracy. And I took a bank bag one night from three hotels and went to Reno, Nevada to make the money I was spending that I had to get back in the safe. And I couldn't do it. And when I went to Reno, no more bag, no money, no nothing. And I called the hotel and admitted I'm an alcoholic. And the guy said, "You've really got some problems." And I said, "What problems?" He says, "Well, you've been indicted by a grand jury." I said, "Grand jury? I'm an alcoholic. I'm a wino. Come on." He says, "Well, that's the deal, Mr. Swanton. They're going to come and get you wherever you are." So I got to San Francisco, tried to lawyer up, didn't have a prayer. They had me probably in about 3 days in San Francisco City Jail, put me in handcuffs, put me on an airplane, and brought me back to Seattle. And so, you can't look good on an airplane in handcuffs. And you're sober. Excuse me. I'm running out of saliva, which is a good thing for the people in the front row, because I normally spit. But I get off the plane, and I get in there, and the indictment stuck. And so I waived my trial rights. I knew what to do. I fired a public defender. Never fire a public defender. Don't fire anybody that can help you in any way. The arrogance came back. I pled nolo, and that's what we do. And the judge looked at me, and he was showing me the procedure that I did in accounting was so stupid. I went to a place where you were trained to be a CPA. And when you graduate there, you take the test, you pass it, and you're good for life there. And it was a pretty good school, but the and embezzled a corporation. I started a company that never existed, wrote checks to it, cashed them. The worst thing I did was the bank bag because it was locked. And then it became conspiracy, and it was a federal charge. So I had two charges. I had one federal and I had one state. And he starts talking about some time. And he said, "Here's what we're offering you, 7. If you want to do federal time," and I couldn't believe, it was like I was in a bad movie. And I was in it, and I was the star all of a sudden. And he said, 7 federal time or 2 to 15 state time. I says, "Is that 2 to 15 months or years?" He didn't like that, so he sent me off to Walla Walla. I took the state deal, and I picked up the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And man, I studied. I needed this thing now, and I knew it because I'm in my life is gone. I'm in a hole now. I got to survive in a prison system. And Walla Walla is a pretty tough place. I don't think any easy places. But I got lucky. I got a clerk's job in there. It's probably the best job you could get. I got a chance to get into the Big Book, and I started AA groups. And I didn't start AA groups to look good, because normally that's my mode. If I'm going to come out ahead of this thing at the end, I'm going to do it. My motive wasn't. It was pure for change. I didn't care what they did. I could recover with this. Got a sponsor, was sponsoring other guys. 18 months came up and they had to hear me because I had a white collar crime. And I went before the parole board and told them what I was doing. I didn't expect to get released. They cut me loose. They says, two conditions of parole. No drinking, no accounting. It's no problem. I had no desire to drink, none. They gave me a party in A block. I was well liked. And hate to say that, I had a good reputation in prison. But I got off the boat on Puget Sound when I crossed back into Seattle, and I was taking the bus up to the halfway house, and I went by a bar. I went by a bar, and the bar said open. And I got off the bus, walked in, and I had to have a beer, just a beer, just to take the edge off. And we know what happens when you have a beer. It opens up this in the back of your brain, the dopamine release. When I got off the bus to walk over there, I started getting high, because I knew what was going to happen. I'm so addicted. And I had two beers. I couldn't get anything else. I wasn't, not that I could have, but so once in a while I'd grab a loot if I could, but I just had to take the edge off doing 18 months, and there's insanity. And I knew it was insanity. I'm looking in the mirror and I did it anyway. I can't stop it. I want to stop it. I know what trouble this is going to be. I got to the halfway house, and at the time we were taking, I think, sense in for your mouth. You take the smell away from the alcohol. And I'm sitting there and I'm waiting for my bedding, and the guy, 2 hours, and two policemen come in. They put me in handcuffs. They brought me right back to the penitentiary. I didn't have to go to court. I didn't have to do anything. They just added 6 months to me. Now I'm doing two, on a 2 to 15. And I realized at that moment about true powerlessness. Alcohol has got me. I don't have it. It'll have me for the rest of my life. And I know that. And you realize it as you're drinking. And you know where it's going to go to. It isn't an alcoholic has no fear. The insanity of this disease dictates that to you. I wish my brain wasn't designed this way. But you see, I'm an alcoholic, mind and body. And when I put it in me, it's over, man. It's over for me. I'm one of those guys that just cannot stay out of trouble. I cannot do it. If I could keep my mouth shut, I wouldn't be where I was. And so I went back. I did my 6 months. Now they got me fighting forest fires. It's a tough job. You got a shotgun in the back of you. And people are dying out there because you're a convict. Nobody really cares. And I swore at that time I'll never put myself in this position again, like I did many times. But they let me out, and they gave me one condition. Don't drink. You do 13, we'll flatten your sentence out. You spit in our face once. That's what the parole people told me. You spit in our face once, do it again. We'll flatten your sentence, 13. I was drunk in 3 hours. And you know, I'm not going back and do time there. So now I'm on what they call the suicide route with alcohol. That between the sheets, that great time that night, if you ever told me, here's a preview of coming attractions, pal, have another one, I would have picked it up anyway. I would have picked it up anyway because I loved it. And it loved me, but now it's turned. And now I can't stop. And so what sounds dramatic, I had to get out of the country. No, where do you go? Where do you go? I know I'm going to drink again. It's not going to get any better. And there's a small NHL team up in Massachusetts that invited me to go up and skate in a place called Tree Revere, which is a training camp. When I was 17, I went up there and skated, and I lasted a whole 2 weeks before I had to go back to Providence. But it was what you call a walk-on today. And I remember the town. It was a small town between Quebec and Montreal. Nobody spoke any English. They just spoke French. I'm going there. Everybody was trying to get out of the draft in San Francisco at the time, 1972. And So I hooked it up and I started going. I started ripping and running. I'd go to an AA meeting, now I know about AA. And one good thing about AA, you got a basket in the back, you can always get money. Somebody's always got a jacket, you can always stay warm. And people in AA leave the keys on the floor of their car with a full tank of gas. I can't believe that. So I arrive in Indianapolis in the car. And this is the period of sobriety where you start losing your clothes. And I get out of the car and I'm in shorts. I have no socks, no shoes, and a t-shirt, and it's snowing. And a policeman's standing there, and I don't know how that always happens. He sent me to Catholic Charities. There was a nun there named Sister Ann Richards. She says, I'm going to send you to a halfway house. She sends me to a halfway house and dresses me up, and I'm doing good. I get a job in an AA club as a cook. And the music is still playing out of the fridge. And I closed the fridge for the eggs. But the guy wanted his eggs over easy or hard. I did them wrong anyway. I threw them on the floor. And defiance. And I walked out to the parking lot and I saw a set of keys in the car. And I got the checkered outfit and the cook's outfit on, the hat. I got in the car and drove off and headed to Chicago. I got busted in Remington, Indiana. Remington's a small town. I got busted for reckless driving in a gas station. They don't check the stolen car. The sheriff of Sheriff Osborne, I'll not forget, I am not drunk. I'm ripping and running. I got to get out of the country. I go back and do 13 as soon as that warrant hits the station. So he takes me in there and he said, what do you need? I said, I need AA. He said, I know two guys that can help you. I said, really? Yes, Leroy and George. Leroy and George, get in the car, come down, bailed me out of jail and took me to the house. I cannot believe this. I cannot believe anybody's dumb enough to let me in the house with their TV or the wife. Either one's going to go. And, these were good guys. They'd take me to meetings. I'd speak, and they'd love to hear me talk. I'm so full of bull. It's going on tonight. Anyway, and I was kind of, these guys were unbelievable. And so, and then I drank. My 87 days went up, I got drunk. They put me on a bus back to Providence. And I will never forget what those two guys did for me. And I'll tell you why, briefly. But anyway, I got there, and I used my sister's car. I was saying goodbye to my family. It's very sad. I was going to die if I would be Canada. I'd never live. And I was going to play hockey anymore. I was beyond that. So I get busted in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, run over a stop sign at my sister's car, and I have to go to court. And it was October 29th, 1972. And that day, I had to stop and have a Boilermaker, only now I'm drinking it with a straw. I was shaking. There was an old guy next to me, and I thought he was going to hit me because I'm so paranoid. I'm so full of fear and terror. And so I showed up for court. I did that much, but I fell down on the floor, and I had one drink. And it was like getting on a plane in handcuffs. You can't look good on the floor in a courtroom. I've always had problems with that. And Jimmy came over. Jimmy Brennan looked at me, and he said, get out. That's all he said. Didn't say bum. And I went to a place, I was talking to this fellow earlier about a Matt Talbot. I went over to a halfway house they sent me, the Matt Talbot house. And I was in there, and I'm on a couch, it was 11 o'clock in the morning. Cool. Two guys are watching the Snow Channel on TV, they're on Thorazine. And, and I'm on the couch, and I start crying like a baby. I start crying like a little girl, and I can't stop. And you know what I thought, my first thought was? I'm losing my mind, thank God. I won't feel it. I won't feel anything. That's my feeling. But I couldn't stop the crying, and I wanted to die so bad. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me at that moment. Because a guy came over and gave me a cup of coffee as I was crying. And the manager came over to me, and he said, do you think you'll drink again? His name was Joe Fitzpatrick. He broke his own anemia, and I said, of course I'll drink again. I always have. Give me 90 days here, and I'll go across the border. I got a live warrant cooking for me right now, 13 years, I'm not going back. And he understood. He says, well, here's what you want to do. He said, I want you to go in the bathroom and pray. He said, don't give me God. He said, just go in there and do what I'm telling you to do. Or, there's the door. Not a lot of choices here, starting to snow out. So, trotted into the bathroom, get on my knees, said to the God I don't believe in, keep me away from the drink, I can't. Restore me to sanity because I'll recycle again and drink anyway, because I always have. and take over my will and my life. And whatever that meant in the third step, I had no idea, but I remember reading it when I was in jail, and I'm going to say it anyway. And I just threw it in there, not as just as an add-on. I don't know what the hell I did. I got off my knees and went back out. I said, you happy? I'm happy, yes. And my sister gave me this little car, and I got a big job as a janitor. And I'm waiting to get busted. I'm sitting at the meeting in the corner looking at everybody coming in. And finally, Eddie the Lion Tamer came over to me and says, hey, there's a guy up in prison. I want you to go over and help. I said, I'll go near a prison. Are you crazy? And this is AA in action now. I had to help him because of what the two guys did to me and what many people did to me in AA. Nobody ever threw me out of here. Everybody always made me feel welcome. Drunk, stealing car. The car I stole in Indianapolis, I told a group in Remington, I stole the car. They said, we don't like them anyway. But they drove the car back, and everybody forgives everybody. Well, I'm going to live here forever. But the thing was, the madness was going to stop, and I didn't know what was going to happen that day. About 87 days went by, and I was working my job. I was going to meetings. I had a car full of guys. If you get in my car, you had to get on your knees or I'd throw you out of the car. I don't want to hear anything. I was sponsoring four guys. Don't ask me how that happened. And I didn't know what was happening in my life, but I know I walked out of that car one day, and I had no desire to drink or get high in any measure. I had enthusiasm for this fellowship that was beyond me. I had a reverence for this gift I was given, and I never felt like that in my life about anything. And I knew something was happening because I became teachable. How do you get teachable? Laying on that floor that day, wanting to die, crying, snot coming out of my nose, praying in a toilet, gets you to change a little bit, gets you to start listening to what they're saying to you. The possibility, you're like, oh, I could never do that. She said 2 minutes. I've got another hour and a half. Anyway. But it took. I couldn't believe it. I never picked up another drink. I stayed teachable. I stayed grateful. If you're grateful now, you do the jails. I still do the jails. I still do the detox. I owe for that gift. I owe, and maybe that's not a right way to feel, but that's the way I feel. When you ask me to speak here, and it's a little bit of a drive, not a big deal, from Sarasota, just left at 3 o'clock, no big deal. Anyway. You go, we have it. But the gift, I want to explain this, and I got a minute and 10 seconds. There was another gift. I got the gift of sobriety. I got the gift of enthusiasm. The gift of a God that loves me. I never thought that would happen to me, because I was a Catholic. It happened. And I get the gift of love. I get the gift of love. You learn to get the gift of love by compassion. By helping others, you get compassion automatically, because these poor buggers are just like I am. And you fall in love with them. But you fell in, there's a deeper love. My love is with me tonight, my Helen. And 10 years sober, I went to see my father, Fred, who was a Jesuit, who was my spiritual advisor, and I said to him one day, Father Fred, I'd like to get a good relationship. He says, well, do you ever think of praying for someone you could love? No, I have to be loved. And he says, try that. I did it. The phone rang that night, and this woman had been stalking me. I didn't know it. Right over there. And she came over that night, and we got 33 years coming up. 30 years coming up. No. Just quickly. How do you get the gift of love? How do you get that gift? They don't even talk about it much around here. Anyway, I love you guys. Thanks for having me tonight.